The following podcast is an Embassy Row production.
Hey, everybody. I'm Mark Lamont Hill, owner of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. I am a professor, a scholar, and most importantly, a book nerd. I say book nerd because I don't just love to read books. I'm the person who loves to read about the book. I love hearing authors talk about how and why they wrote the book, and I love talking to other book nerds about their favorite books. That's why I started Coffee and Books. It's a podcast all about books. Every episode, I sit down over a cup of coffee with the world's biggest authors to discuss the most interesting, controversial, fun, or important books. And sometimes we hang out with experts, fans, and other special guests to talk about some of the greatest books of all time. And today, I am happy to be talking about this topic, this book, this subject, this region, and this author. The book is called Chronicling Stankonia, The Rise of the Hip Hop South. And I am joined right now by the book's brilliant author. She is Assistant Professor of English and African Diaspora Studies at Kennesaw State University. She is Dr. Regina Bradley. Good to see you.
What's going on, young man? How you?
I'm hanging in there. I am hanging in there. This is a real pleasure, man. As a hip hop, you are the first person on the show to be talking about hip hop, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
Your Rolodex is so thick, though. Like,
I know, but the book got to be right. You know.
Oh, okay.
You know, because sometimes people come in. You know, we have them on the show, and they have a lot of areas of expertise. Like we had Michael Eric Dyson, but we didn't do the Jay-Z book here. We did a different book. Then we've had like Imani Perry, brilliant hip hop scholar, but she was talking about Breathe. So we've had hip hop scholars here before, but this is the first hip hop book that we've had at the center. And so that makes me very happy. But before we talk about your book,
okay,
this is a coffee and book show. So I am right now drinking a cappuccino. You know, I got my espresso, a little, some steamed milk.
Oh, you're just fanciful, young man.
I am. I mean, I got a coffee shop, so I've become fancy with my coffee drinking. And I got a really, really, really nice cup of cappuccino here. Are you a coffee drinker? What you drink?
Man, it depends on how my spirit moved me. You know what I'm saying? I'm more so of a vanilla latte type girl.
Vanilla latte. See?
I'm simple, man. I'm simple. It's the simple things in life. You know what I'm saying?
Look, ain't nothing wrong with a nice vanilla latte if you make it right. You know what I mean? But for those out there that's not coffee nerds, you know, that latte is also steamed milk. The differences between the latte and the cappuccino is just how you steam the milk and how much foam you create on the top of that mix between the milk and a shot of espresso. And then you put a little bit of vanilla syrup in there and you got a nice vanilla latte. It's actually quite tasty. That used to be one of my addictions. I've been trying to cut down on the sugar a little bit. So the cappuccino makes me feel like I'm doing something special, but I drink a lot of it when I'm writing. Are you like a coffee while you write person?
Nope. I am a water girl. Like I hydrate to the point where my folks thought I was diabetic when I was younger because I didn't drink no Kool-Aid. They were like, why are you just drinking all this water? They were like, she just like water. And I'm like, that's right.
Wow. You are the first person here. I've heard people tell me they drink whiskey. I've had people tell me they smoke weed. I've had people tell me all kinds of coffee. You were the first person to tell me that they drink water while
they... I'm simple, man. Simple. I don't know. I might have to try the weed thing out later, though. No.
It might work for you. Book number two, we'll know. We'll know how from the quality of book number two. But book number one is amazing. It's called Chronicling Stankonia, The Rise of the Hip-Hop South. Why'd you write this book?
Because I was sick and tired of New York being the center of hip hop studies, period. That's it. Mm,
that's an interesting point. So say more about that. I mean, as you're talking about it, you're right. I mean, New York has long been the center of when we study hip hop, we talk about what's happening in New York.
But what's happening in New York don't translate all over the country, all over the world. You know what I'm saying? I'm from Southwest Georgia. Like the running joke that I tell my students in my Outkast class is like, yo, the subway was a form of transportation in New York. That shit is just a sandwich where I'm from. You know what I mean? So like, it needs to be translatable. But I mean, I was in Dr. Portia Maltzby's Black Pop Music class at Indiana University. And we were, you know, having a conversation about hip hop. And we were, you know, reading all the folks, Trisha Rose, Mark Anthony Neal, a little bit of Monty Perry, you know what I mean? Guy Ramsey. And I was like, yo, this is brilliant. But this don't speak to nothing that's in my car at the moment. Like this will speak to nothing I'm listening to. And Dr. Mosby didn't know, she knew what she was doing. I didn't know what she was doing, but she knew what she was doing. She was like, yo, what you gonna do about it? And I'm like, I don't know, something. So it wasn't really until like 2014 when I was done with graduate school that I really started recognizing like, yo, there is very little on Southern rap in these scholarly conversations. And I didn't like being marginalized like that. So I was like, yo, let me speak on it and where else to start but Outkast. You would think that there's so many articles and things on everybody from Wu-Tang to Nas to Jay-Z to Lil' Kim. And I'm like, nobody's checking for the cast? Like, come on now. So it was like my academic love letter to the group, you know what I mean? And also to borrow from Three Stacks, be like, yo, the South got something to say, and who else to say it but a Southerner?
So let's start with that. I mean, actually, in the first chapter of the book, that's one of the things you talk about, right, is Outkast and that moment. For those that don't know, Outkast is one of the great hip hop groups of all time. In my estimation, the greatest rap group of all time, you know, and it's a very small conversation for me. It's between Tribe, Outkast. Actually, it's between Tribe and Outkast for me, and it just depends on what day you ask me, but most days I'm going to say...
Yeah, that's going to depend on how your spirit's feeling.
Yeah, exactly. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. But Outkast in 1995 went to the Source Awards, which for a very short-lived set of event, right? The Source Awards, which is like hip-hop awards, they've had some iconic moments. Suge Knight and, of course, Outkast. And Andre 3000, Andre Benjamin, one of the two members of Outkast, stood up while getting an award and said the South got something to say. And tell me why that moment was so iconic for hip hop.
Yo, because I mean, like, what's fascinating, Mark, and this is me talking to another academic, is that of all the hip hop studies in place, I really haven't read too much about the 95 Source Awards. Like, you would think, because it was such a pivotal moment, that more folks would pay attention to it. But the reason that Three Stacks getting up was so important, well, there's a couple of reasons. One, it proves that, you know, he was going through his transformation before Erykah Badu. You know what I mean? Before he got completely Baduized. Right. He was already getting woke. He had the purple dashiki on, you know what I'm saying? He was already kind of like starting to go through his transformation, his wokeness. And then you have Big Boy, who's like, I mean, like, the whole thing was just shade. Like, I feel like the whole thing was shade on their half, because you have Big Boy, who's shown he got home training, but then he says, Dre, what's up? You know what I'm saying? And if you're Southern, you're like, oh, that means that some shit is about to pop off. And he's it's like this though. And I'm like, see, that further lets me know. And he was frustrated and stuttering through the whole thing. You know what I'm saying? And then he was like, the South got something to say. And that's all I got to say. It wasn't that Atlanta got something to say. It wasn't that Georgia got something to say. It was like the South. Like, he recognized, I don't know if it was inadvertently or he knew what he was saying, but he was recognizing that Southern hip hop was a thing, and now it was officially on the map. And it was the rallying cry. It was the hootie hoo, and folks stood up and was like, oh, word. And Southerners haven't looked back since. Like, we kicked the door open and that's it.
Wow. What do you think we miss when we talk about the North at the expense of the South? In other words, what does the South offer hip hop and music more broadly that we miss out on?
I just feel like it's a type of storytelling that is made legible to non-Southerners, you know what I'm saying? And just the way that the South has one foot in the past, one foot in the future. We always trying to struggle to get through the present because we're always struggling to figure out what that identity is. And then on the other end, you have folks telling us, oh, this is what it means to be Southern and Black. It means to be traumatized. It means to be victims. It means to be backwards, all these things. And Southern rap pushes back like, nah, that might be part of it, because I'm not going to say that no Southerners are traumatized and, you know, all of that stuff. But at the same time, it's like, we need a more complicated narrative. Like, that's the thing that scares people, is that the South is a complicated space. It's not monolithic. What happens to me in Georgia is different than what's happening to folks in Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana. But a universal thread for us is the music. You know what I mean? So like that idea of collaboration. And then probably on top of that is like where folks pull the inspiration for the music from, right? Like when we think about Cast and Dungeon Family in particular, you hear the significance of the funk influence, because Atlanta was a funk capital before it was a hip hop capital. And folks don't really recognize that, which is kind of interesting. I'm like, really? So like when you think about SOS Band and Cameo, and for me, my dad introduced me to all of these funk bands. Like, that was part of our Sunday playlist after church. I didn't realize until I was writing the book, I was like, damn, my dad set me up for this book, because he set me up to realize the connection between funk music and hip hop in Atlanta. So, I mean, you think about folks like Sleepy Brown, his dad, Jimmy Brown, was part of Brick. So he was on the side of these performances and gathering it all in. So when we hear the falsetto and hear him doing his thing, it's all sonic genealogy, right? Like, it's all sonically connected. And I think that that's something that Southern rap really builds on, is the use of cultural memory to create and remix something new.
To what extent do we not appreciate the genius of Southern rap because of our sort of stereotypes about what the South is? Like, you talked about being backwards and things like that. I mean, I've had these arguments with, I have a brother, and I have multiple brothers, but I have one brother in particular who I argue about rap with. And for the longest time, I said, you know, Andre 3000's in my top five. I mean, he would, 5-10 years ago, he would clown me for saying that.
Why?
Because he said that it's just some country stuff and that they couldn't rap, right? And I think that when you start talking about great groups, whether it's UGK, whether it's, I mean, 8-Ball NJG, you know, people a lot of times in the North don't appreciate them as lyricists, and they might like a song or two, especially 10 years ago. Now it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like there was a time when, like, the South didn't even get recognized for having lyrical ability because there was assumption that because they were Southern, they weren't sophisticated.
Yeah. There's, I mean, the other part of it, too, is delivery, right? Like, you know, some folks have a twang that folks are like, I don't even know what that means, right? And the one thing that I'm starting to think about now is the distinction between urban and rural in the South in ways I really haven't been thinking about it before. So, like, when we think about, you know, with Imani Perry, she introduces this idea of the urban South in Prophets in the Hood, right?
Yeah.
And she uses Outkast as the example for that. But what's interesting is that for a while, especially in the early 2000s, there was a pushback against urban South rappers, like rappers from Atlanta and all of that, right? Who were like, nah, we ain't country. And I'm like, I'm offended. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm country as hell. Like, there's a distinction, I think, in experience that goes back to what I talk about in the book and the understanding that the South is not a monolith. And even within the state itself, it's not a monolith, right? So, like, one of the things that makes me want to throw hands is when I say I'm from Georgia and folks automatically assume I'm from Atlanta. And I said, I ain't say I was from Atlanta. I said I'm from Georgia. And then they'd be like, oh, my bad. But then the next question is, oh, how far is Albany from Atlanta? Like, it's the visualization. It's like the touch point, right?
Yeah.
And I think that what happens is that the further outside of the perimeter, so to speak, that you get when you think about the South, especially when you're thinking about, you know, the rural South, like where I'm from, rural small town South, is that the experiences also aren't the same. So, like, you have these increasing levels of illegibility, so to speak, so that when you hear folks like, you know, for me being from Albany, of course, we'll talk about Phil Mob, right? So, like, you hear from Phil Mob, if you listen to the first album, Channel 619, it's totally different almost from, you know, the next joints from the Rooter to the Tooter, even though that's a country-ass name, but it's different because the audience is expanding. But there's still that anxiety, I think, because of the fact that we want to keep the South in this particular flattened space because it's easier to digest. It's easier to be like, oh, they're inferior to us because they don't have the same economic, social, cultural capital that we recognize as legitimate. And a lot of that is grounded in the idea of what do you do with a contemporary South? What do you do with it? You don't know what to do with it because it strays so far away from what we have been indoctrinated with in civil rights documentaries and photographs and media about this is what the Black South is, it's what the Black South can do. And Southern rap is like, yeah, that's what we did, but this is what we're doing now. And that makes folks uncomfortable that you have to, basically, you as a listener, you need to step your game up. Like, just because this is what your grandmama and them said, this is what the South is, don't mean that's exactly the same thing now.
But is this identity of the urban South and artists, you know, that have come out of the urban South, whether it's T.I. or other folk, are they aspiring to be Northerners who just happen to live in the South? Is that the issue?
I don't think so, man, because, you know, I've had a lot of issues with what Tip has said and done these last couple years. But one thing that he said that I agreed with was he was like, we don't need New York to tell us what our classics are. You know what I'm saying? And I think that that's important, is that urban Southern spots have their own distinctive signature position. It's not always, well, what is New York doing? And I think that's what Tip was saying. It's like, just because it's happening in New York doesn't mean that translates or that it's wanted in these different places. And it's not even just Tip. Like, I'm thinking about, you know, Kiese Layman, for example, in his essay, you know, How Hip Hop Stole My Southern Black Boy. He was like, yo, at one point in time, it was what New York was doing and we tried to emulate that. But once we recognized that Southern rap was its own thing, then all of that went out the window and a new set of standards kind of got into play. So I just feel like the one thing that we need to do in terms of just thinking about hip hop, and I'm thinking as an academic and just as a fan of the culture, is that, yo, when we decenter New York, folks lose their shit. It's not that decentering them is being disrespectful. I don't think it's disrespecting this, it's the origin. You know what I mean? I'm not taking that away. But what I am saying is that the way that hip hop manifests and reproduces itself in New York is different than the way that it manifests below the Mason-Dixon line across the deep South. And it's okay. Like, I think that's the problem, is like, it's not taken away from whatever New York has put into place or whatever the West Coast has put into place. You know what I mean? And going back to that, the Source Awards, I just remember like a young and very angry Snoop Dogg, like, y'all don't love us. Like, we all supposed to do this hip hop thing. And he's like, yo, y'all don't love us.
Right. You ain't got no love for Snoop Dogg. You ain't got no love for Death Row.
Yeah. You know, like, you saw that his world famous, like, you know, snarl, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, like, now I think it's interesting because it makes me think about we're in a digital era now, and the way that the that hip hop was regionalized in the 90s and the early 2000s is not even the case anymore, because all you can do is go to a website, you know what I mean, and be like, okay, I think I want to sound like Future today, designer.
right.
How do I do that? Or I think I want to sound like this today. That's cool. But yeah, I just think that what's interesting is that the culture is moving forward, but like the conversations and the language to talk about the culture are still rooted in a particular moment in hip hop. And that's problematic. That's a challenge.
Has anything shifted? I mean, there's a way now when you turn on the radio in New York, even. And New York heads complain about this all the time, that almost all the hip hop you hear is not from New York anymore. That it's that a lot of it is Southern rappers. You got even Northern rappers trying to sound like they're Southern.
Southern rap, yeah.
And you got Northern rappers joining Southern. I mean, Nicki Minaj is from Queens, but she signed to Young Money.
Yeah, but she's also got roots in the Caribbean. She's global Southern. We claiming her.
I'll let you have that. But it's very interesting to see that many of the biggest names in hip hop are people who are either from the South,
right,
or are connected to Southern rap labels. Has the South become the new New York? Is it that we've shifted the Mecca, or is it that there's just multiple centers? What's happening?
I feel like there's multiple Meccas now. I feel like, you know, you can never take away from New York, it's the origin point, but I feel like Atlanta has become a Mecca, because so many subgenres of hip hop have come out of Atlanta. So many, you know, subgenres have come out of New Orleans. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, like, I just feel like, you know, the spotlight has to be shared a little bit. The other part of it too is it could be connected to this idea of a reverse migration. Folks are coming back South, whether it's sonically, culturally, physically, folks are coming home, so to speak. In addition to that, they are utilizing the culture that is in place in these different places that they're going to. But one of the things I think is interesting too is that post-Katrina, I feel, is a significant shift in how we understand the South, because of so many displaced folks, and they went all over the country, but a lot of them went all over the South, and that remixed what we thought Southern rap can and cannot do, for me at least. And then, you know, you get to 2008 with Soulja Boy and MySpace and Mr. Collie Park, formerly known as DJ Smurf. He's using MySpace and Tom to get signed to a record deal. And folks are like, oh, well, if you could do that with, you know, MySpace, what can we do with all these other things that pop up? So I just feel like the way that we engage and consume the culture has shifted. And with that shift, you have to recognize how it's taking root differently. I mean, I think it's just what any kind of culture does, any pop culture does. It adapts. If we're thinking about pop culture and social media, for example, and tying it to hip hop was introduced to so many different people because of the immediate access to social media. Like, I think it's both the gift and the curse. Like, the curse part of it is I miss how social media has pushed out some of these other spaces where hip hop was consumed and defined, like the record store, for example. Like, I miss going to the record store and trying to decide which album I'm going to buy for the week, and knowing somebody on the other side, it'd be like, yo, go ahead and play the whole album, and I'm still gonna buy it. I just think it's done something in terms of fracturing not only the culture itself, but also how we engage the culture. And because of that, we're recognizing that the way that the culture is engaged shifts depending on what part of the country you're in or what part of the world you're in, even. And I think that that's something that we need to grapple with and think through. So
you mentioned Kiese Layman earlier, who's obviously a favorite of this show and of mine for sure.
My big cuz. I love him.
Yeah, he's the best. When we talk about that book, Long Division, I mean, he invokes the issue of storytelling. He brings up storytelling, talks about Outkast. And there's this idea that Outkast can even become a framework for thinking about Southern storytelling. You deal with this in your book as well. What is distinctive about, what is Southern storytelling?
I feel like Southern storytelling is, it doesn't shy away from the messy, like the good, the bad, the messy. You know what I mean? The one thing about that I absolutely love about Kiese's writing is it's devastatingly good. Like, he doesn't shy away from the things that make you uncomfortable, or, you know, one of the ways I'm thinking about it is make you less spectable, so to speak. So like, when Long Division comes out, I didn't know what to do with it when I first read it, because I was like, I've been asking for a contemporary Southern novel that focuses on Black folks, because when you think about Southern lit, you automatically go to dead white folks, from Faulkner to, you know, Flannery O'Connor.
Faulkner's the one, right.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And I'm like, man, I ain't got nothing to do with that. So Kiese comes out with Long Division, and you have all of these young Black characters who are just like, that sounds like my cousin. That sounds like my dude up the street. But I think what makes it stand out is that with the art of storytelling, especially if there's hip hop aesthetics involved, is that central to that is you take the pain and make it center, and you don't shy away from it to make something beautiful. As debilitating as Long Division is, because I mean, like, it's really a sad ass story. Like, if you really sit with it, you're like, just wow, you know what I'm saying? And the idea of generational trauma and anxiety built upon each other, and using time traveling, which is something that Southerners do on a daily basis. We time travel every day. We have to deal with folks who feel like the Confederate flag is still a thing. We got to deal with folks who are like, white supremacy is something that you're making up in your head. You know what I mean? We got to deal with the trauma of grandparents, aunties, whoever survived Jim Crow, and they put that on us. And all of that was part of the book in ways that, you know, we need to find different ways to do it. And I'm not saying that KSA is the first one to do it, because if you look at the lineage in Mississippi, you know what I'm saying? You definitely see influences of Margaret Taylor and Richard Wright. All of these folks are like in conversation, but the difference is that hip hop is like the soundtrack. Like, he talks about Big Crit before he gets baptized. He talks about Outkast, and twice upon a time there was a boy who died. You know, like literally taking this idea of two boys named City, and they're in conversation with each other through a book, a talking book. So, you know, shout out to the Skip Gates, you know, the idea of the talking book trope. But what is the thing that is helping them think through the book? It's literally Outkast. It's dope. It's dope. It's amazing.
Well, you talked about Southern Black girlhood as well.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about what it means to navigate the South, and particularly hip hop, through the lens of Black Southern girlhood.
Man, it's hard out here. But for real, like, on the one hand, it's like, you know, if we're thinking about politics and respectability and not necessarily thinking about it from the perspective of Evelyn Brooks Higginbottom, right, when she was talking about Black women in the church, but how it has kind of gained its own legs. When I was coming up in the South, you know, my grandmother is the Southern debutante. She is the classiest woman I ever know. She's quiet. She's sweet. You know, she got shade. It's wonderful when she throws shade at people, because you have to think about what she said. Like, wait, what? But she had in her mind a particular way that I needed to present myself as the young Black woman in the South in order for me to not only maintain my respectability, but also the respectability of the family. Because that's one of the other things that stand out in the South. It ain't just you. It's you and then your people. And I feel like that's amplified as a girl. It's like, okay, you can't be out here shaking your ass and enjoying your life at the parties or the dances or whatever, because somebody's going to call your house and be like, we saw Regina and she was acting unladylike. Like, right, I just, right. And then be like, how was you acting unladylike? You out here in the public, all you have is your name type stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So for me, Southern hip hop was an escape. It was like, all right, all these things I can't talk about. I can't talk about sex. I can't, like, my grandmother had a strict set of rules. Like, you can't hug boys. You can't call them past whatever. You can't, you know, can't get in the car with boys. Ain't gonna be no boys. The hilarious part is that my two best friends, who are still my best friends today, are boys. And they were just like, you know what? It's just weird. But I remember specifically when Trina came out with The Baddest Bitch in 1999. That's when the hormones were turning on. I didn't know what to do, because I'm a good, clean Christian girl. You know what I'm saying? And I'm like, well, how can I be the baddest bitch and that's not ladylike? You know what I'm saying? And Trina was like, I don't give a damn about being a lady. Like, this is what you need to do. And then Joy comes out with Lick. You know what I'm saying? And I'm just like, what? So yeah, I had to hide those albums under the bed. But yeah, I just feel like Southern hip hop was an opportunity to escape, and also a different way of thinking about how we run through the world. So like, when I think about, in that particular chapter, I talk about Sasha Thumper as a theorization of Southern Black girlhood.
Yeah, can we talk about, and for those of the artist storytelling, part one is again, a classic Outkast song, one of my favorite songs. And there's two characters, two Black girls, right? There's Susie Screw and Sasha Thumper. Big Boy's rapping about Susie Screw, and then Andre's rapping about Sasha Thumper. And I like both of these verses. It's really dope. But I'm sorry, I just want to get that context for those who are Outkast heads. Go ahead.
Yeah. But I also think it speaks to like what we expect out of Outkast. Of course, when we think about Big Boy, we expect him to talk about pimping, sipping, pimping, sipping, pimping. So of course he's going to talk about this hookup that doesn't go the way he wants it to. So he just get a little head and she keep moving. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But like with Andre, he gives you this fully fleshed out, vulnerable story. Like, I was young, I was trying to figure out what to do with myself. And there was this girl, and like, you know, when he's like, I remember her number like the summer. Like, you know, like, kids don't understand, you would have these pieces of paper in your pocket.
Yes.
And a pen or a pencil. So when you went to the mall, to the skating rink, whatever, and you met somebody you want to holler at, you write down on a piece of paper, you know what I'm saying? And then get mad when you lose the paper, you know what I mean?
You keep checking your pocket, making sure it's still in there.
Yeah, you're making sure it's still there, you know what I'm saying? And then, you know, but yeah, so it's like, you know, but then he's like, what you want to be, which is a question I feel is loaded, especially for Southerners, because it's like, there's a particular idea of exceptionalism for young Black Southerners. You're supposed to do this because we did the Civil Rights Movement and you're supposed to be exceptional in everything you do. And so Sasha Thumper comes out with, alive.
Alive. I asked her what she want to be. She said alive. Woo.
Yeah, so when I'm reading Long Division and you get to this section and Shalaya Crimp was like, can you help me find myself in the future? I'm like, what? Alive! Yeah, so just this idea of trying to simply be in a society that doesn't want us. And of course, I was like, you know what? Because it's academics, you got to show receipts. And I'm like, Anna Julia Cooper talks about this in her book. So when she's like, the Black women in the South are a fatal shivering class. I'm like, there it is. Sacha Thumba been around since the 1800s. You know what I'm saying? And she just changed form. So being able to just exist, right? Like the agency of Black girls and women in the South is such a it's underappreciated. And I mean, you got folks like Zora Neale Hurston and Alice Walker, you know what I mean?
Of course, right.
But I just feel like they need to be in conversation with some of these newer representations of hip hop girlhood and womanhood in the South. And of course, you know, since I was using Outkast as a theoretical framework, of course, I'm going to use the art of storytelling part too, to be like, you know, Shalaya Crump is the ellipsis of Sacha Thumper.
Mm.
And that ellipsis is, you know, a break in time, literally a break in time, a break in thought, right? And I'm like, well, duh, that's the South all over it. So.
Wow. And so when you read the work of, you mentioned Kinsey Layman, we see the fingerprints of Outkast. Another great new generation Southern writer, of course, is Jesmyn Ward.
Yes, the GOAT.
Yes. Yo, we all love Jesmyn Ward. And when I think about Esh.
And Salvage the Bones.
Yeah, and Leon from Salvage the Bones. Thank you. And Sing Unburied, Sing a Novel. Those characters. I guess my question is, do you see the same fingerprints of hip hop in Jesmyn Ward's work as you do Kinsey Layman?
Yeah, man. I mean, like, you know, the folks who try to make her as the next Faulkner going to get their feelings hurt. But I'm like, Jesmyn Ward is a trap writer. Jesmyn Ward write about the trap in Mississippi. You know what I mean? Like the trap has become mobile. But I mean, like thinking about the idea of nihilistic Black masculinity and poverty in the South, Jesmyn Ward does that.
Mm.
That's why I put her in conversation with Tip. The way that they use trap aesthetics to talk about a particular type of Southern Black masculinity, a young Black masculinity, I think is really interesting. But with what Mimi does, is really put it on particular, like put it in the spotlight in a particular way that she humanizes the trap in the same way that Tip humanizes the trap. And the one that connects them together is this idea of grieving and how you grieve. So I mean, like, you know, of course you got like the Mount Rushmore with Jeezy and Gucci. I don't agree with Tip that he started trap music. He branded trap music. I'll give him that. But I feel like what he does with it is he humanizes it in such a way is that and the way that he grieves his loved ones, his friends, his homies, you know, I'm like on every single album, you know what I'm saying? Like he is RIPing somebody. And then when Phalon Johnson is murdered in front of him, that does something completely different to his music.
Yeah.
But I just feel like the way that he grieves is really intriguing and putting that in conversation with the way that Jesmyn uses the page to grieve for those who will get pushed to the side because it's not respectable. So like when in Men We Reap, for example, it's a memoir about her, but she's talking about these four or five men that meant a lot to her that would otherwise get pushed to the side. One was a drug dealer, one was a user. You know what I'm saying? It was like, how do you put that in conversation? And it's not trap music per se, but it's trap writing. Like she's talking about the shit that happens in the trap.
Yeah.
Faulkner couldn't do that shit. Like Faulkner couldn't write about the trap. I'm just saying.
I think that's a fair assessment. Another thing you talk about in the book is the way that slavery in the sort of memory of slavery, the kind of looming presence of slavery and the history, yep, of slavery kind of play out in the hip hop Southern music and Southern imagination. Can you talk about that? Because that's something I haven't really thought about in that way before.
Yeah, so I mean, like, when I first started that chapter, it was a part of my dissertation project, and it was a little bit more general, right? Like, I've always been in love with Edward P. Jones' The Known World. It just really shakes up the whole conversation about Black slave owners because they were really a thing. Folks want to act like they weren't. But when I really kind of started thinking about the interviews that he was doing along with it, he was like, he was hating on hip-hop and MTV, and like, you know, it'd be a thing. And I was like, wait a minute, wait, let me sit with this. Because what ends up happening is I reread his interview that he does with Mary Ann McGraham, and mm-hmm. I'm like, in particular, he's talking about Southern rap because he's like Silver P. I'm like Master P. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a particular regional bias that's associated with this. But then Underground comes out, which is hella underrated. They should have brought it back.
Yeah.
Underground that comes out. And the very first thing, like the very first thing that comes on with Underground is you're listening to Black Skinheads by Kanye as you see this man run for his life, escaping from slavery. I'm like, really? So it was jarring at first because I'm like, it's supposed to be in the 1800s. Like, okay, there was no hip hop. But then at the same time, it was the way that it was placed. Misha Green knew what she was doing, right? It was like, okay, so like where he literally couldn't breathe, you heard Kanye breathing on the track. It was amazing. So I was like, so we're still trying to figure out how to deal with the impact of slavery, we want to think about it in these kind of like abstract terms, but being able to use hip hop to apply it. And then you get something like Django Unchained, right? And you got Rick Ross talking about 100 black coffins as Django was walking to Candyland looking for his wife. I'm like, it's a lot. It's like, how do you articulate these anxieties that are not just restricted to this particular time period? You use the music and the sound to do it. That's what I was trying to get at, is like the use of alternative methods of storytelling, alternative methods of delivery. Because if you're just sticking with history, none of that would work. Like, it just wouldn't work. Like, okay, Django Unchained would have just been like something like Roots. This happened. But with the introduction of contemporary music, particularly hip hop, it's like, yeah, this happened. This could have happened. Let me make sure that you feel the totality of the emotional spectrum it's providing, because there's very little language in place to articulate. How do you deal with a Mandingo fighter that's being shredded apart by dogs while you're listening to 100 black coffins? It's not like you can, you know, you put those together. It's a really powerful moment. Like, you know, as much issues I have with Quentin Tarantino, he really did that on that particular part of the movie. I was like, wow. But yeah, I mean, like, just finding different ways to engage it. And then the other part of it too is I'm not a historian. That's the other part. That's the other reason that I was like, let me find a different way to engage this.
Right.
Because there are wonderful historians who are doing the work, right? Who are using the archive. But I'm just like, what if we can use pop culture as a different way to engage the memory associated with enslavement and get folks to really think about the significance of why this continues to be at the center of how we understand the Southern Black experience? Still, it's 2021 and folks are still like, you know, slavery does X, Y, and Z, and rightfully so, right? I just find it interesting that folks rather think about it in an abstract way and not to actually talk to some of the descendants of those folks, like what we're doing. And I'm thinking about Outkast in particular. Like, Big Boy was like, back in slavery, I bet we were some cool ass niggas. Nobody thinks about the cool aspect of slavery, but he's like, you needed something to survive. Mm. We need to think about something.
Right.
So I just feel like it brings out a different side of the narrative for folks to consider.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about the music too, because we've talked a lot about the kind of abstract stuff, but you also in your book talk about the different Outkast albums and what they were trying to do.
It was a challenge. It was a challenge because I didn't want it to read like a review.
Yeah.
Like, you like, I like this album. These songs, da-da-da-da-da. I mean, you know how long it took me to write that particular chapter? It took me years to get it where I wanted it to go.
Because
I was like, it sounds like a review and I don't want it to be a review. I'm like, I need this to be serious and critical.
So talk to me about some of these albums, right? Because I went to college in fall of 96. Mm-hmm. So when I got to Morehouse College as a freshman, I thought the only thing they played on the radio was the A.T. Elliott's album. Yeah. I actually didn't. I thought that, does Outkast own this radio station? It was like, that's all you heard. I'm talking about from Elevators to the Babyface remix of Jazzy Bell. Like, I'm talking about like all day, all night. It was all Outkast. And I fell in love with Outkast, right? And mm-hmm. I'm a huge Outkast fan. And I fell in love with them because of that A.T. Elliott's album. When I was up north in high school, Southern Playlisted Cadillac Music had come out and we would hear Players Ball.
Mm-hmm.
And it would come on the Video Jukebox channel. And
Wow, throwback.
So, right. So it was like one song and it was like Outkast, and they seemed cool, but they weren't field changing. They weren't genre changing for me in Philadelphia in 94.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But by the time I got to Atlanta and they were suddenly everywhere, and the album, I happen to think A.T. Elliott's, you know, a lot of times there are people who, and I think the Fugees are like this, but not to the same extreme. Because I think Southern Playlisted Cadillac Music is an amazing album. A.T. Elliott's to me is a classic album.
Mm.
You know, Fugees, The Score was the second album was the classic album. And so for me, same thing. I liked the Fugees' the first album. Then it was like, okay. Then Score came out. I was like, oh, yeah. Shit. Like, this is something else. Same thing happened with A.T. Elliott's for me. And then from there, it never stopped. They just kept making classic albums. For you, in the book you talk about this, sort of what it meant to be in high school, what it meant to be listening to these songs, watching the marching band try to play the transcribing the music. You talk about being surrounded by that in Albany, Georgia, of all places.
Yeah.
How did those albums hit you and which ones hit you the most?
Equipment hit me the hardest because Equipment came out my freshman year of high school and I was trying to make it. Equipment hit me the hardest. So today is my favorite Perfect album. Yesterday was A.T. Elliott's, actually. Today is Equipment. But yeah, I mean, because it was so many different things. Like, emotionally, I was all over the place because teenage hormones. But on top of that, I was a high school freshman trying to holler at a high school senior. And a high school senior was trying to let me down delicately and was just like, this ain't going to work.
Right.
So I mean, like, then listening to Spodio Double. I mean, I feel like 98, 99 was such a significant year for me in Southern rap because I got Aquemini and I also got 400 Degrees. I remember being at homecoming at the dance and I felt I was bougie and grown because I got to wear a strapless dress to the homecoming dance. And I had me a little date, you know what I'm saying? And then all of a sudden you just hear doom, 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 doom. And folks was like on the side of the walls. And all of a sudden everybody just come out to the middle of the floor. It was just kind of like Cash Money take over for the 99 and 2000. We were like, we here, we taking over. What's up? So there was that. But like Stankonia is special for me because Bombs Over Baghdad was my run to lunch anthem because I had the last lunch. You know what I mean? And, yeah. And there might be some folks out there who relate. You got like three schedules of lunch. I was the last one and I was at the top level of the school and the cafeteria is way at the bottom. So it was like, if you wanted to get a good spot in line to get hot pizza and hot chicken tenders. So like in my head, Bombs Over Baghdad would play. But like, that's not even my favorite thing about Stankonia. My favorite thing about Stankonia is Kim and Cookie, period. The skit Kim and Cookie. Like I just remember walking down the hallway and folks would just be randomly throwing out lines from Kim and Cookie, like rang, rang. And then somebody way down the hallway be like, say hello, Cookie. Somebody else be like, hello.
Wow.
I mean, it's just that, but I mean like, I don't know. I just feel like my whole life has been impacted by OutKast from high school to, you know, it was Centennial Homecoming at, you know, the unsinkable Albany State when Speaker Box and Love Below came out. I remember not sleeping and listening to Speaker Box all day, every day. If you was trying to get some or do some things, you would listen to the Love Below. You know what I'm saying?
I remember those days well.
Yeah. And then, you know, when I met my husband, the first thing that he sent me, I don't know if you remember these, Mark, but do you remember like the little e-music cards you could send through the email? So like the first email card that he sent me was one of these e-cards and Prototype was playing. His game was quite flat.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, his game was flat. And then when we got married, our first song, our introduction song was International Players. So
one of the great verses in hip hop history.
Ever. I mean, like, I love the opening of the video. Like, folks don't appreciate the opening of the video. You got Three Stacks and it's Kilt.
Right.
You got Bumby, 3-6 Mafia, they all in there.
Right.
And Bumby looking at him like, in a skirt, man? Like, right. It was great. Yeah, it's amazing. It's just amazing how they continue to be relevant. They'll always be relevant for me, but it's just really interesting how we are continuously revisiting them. Kind of interesting too that there's been a sudden reinterest in OutKast in ways that I didn't see in the earlier 2010s. Yeah. Ever since the OutKast reunion tour, I've seen more interest in it interest in them.
Is it hard to write about somebody? Like I think about one day I always say I'm going to write something on Luther Vandross.
What?
Yeah, and for me, I'm always trying to think about how I can have critical distance. Right. How do I write about somebody that I care about this much and who I admire this much and still do the work justice and find the quote unquote truth and the deeper insights, right? Some of which may not be favorable to the people I'm analyzing. How hard was it for you to be this deep into OutKast and write a book on OutKast?
It was hard. This book, I got under contract for this book in 2015 and it's just coming out now. And most of that was because I struggled through that one chapter. Well, that chapter and the chapter on Jesmyn Ward and T.I., the trap chapter, because I talked about the unexpected death of my dad and how Urban Legend got me through that. But it was exactly what you're saying. I'm like, I love these dudes. Like, I don't want to say like I've done no wrong, but like looking back on it, and I feel like this is something that other authors do on this side of the fence. It's weird being on this side of the fence too, by the way.
Yeah.
It's different over here. But like going back and reading through it, I'm just like, man, I should have talked about this, this, and this, which is which I'm putting together for the second book. So like on the one hand, I feel like I don't want to romanticize OutKast. I don't think I romanticized OutKast, but I feel like I could have been more critical in terms of how to think about gender, for example, and women, which is already working on the second book about that. But yeah, it's hard because it's like a lot of people are like, you're not tired of OutKast? I'm like, I'll never get tired of OutKast, you know, like ever. But I think that's the challenge, is being able to distance myself enough because there's so many personal milestones that are connected to the music. I had to put that in the back of my head as I'm writing. And the other part of it too is it helped to have accountability partners too, to like read through it and be like, are you sure this is how you want to say this? Or, you know, so it was useful to have that to kind of keep me on track as I was going through what I was trying to say. So.
Wow. Well, it comes through in the book, that level of care and precision.
Thank you.
And discipline and critical distance at the same time that you make it very clear that you love them and you ain't never going to stop loving them. And that's important, I think, for us to do as writers. But talk to me about your writing. What is your writing process? How would you describe your writing process?
We in a Pangea. Ain't been no writing process for the last year. Man, I want to shout out Bettina Love right here. Dr. Bettina Love, because she gets on my nerves. Because I remember she was looking at my computer when we were writing together one time. And she saw 11 million stickies, like the sticky notes app on the on the Mac. It was like everywhere. And she's like, all of that's for your book? I was like, you need to mind your business. Mind your business. But I mean, like, that's how it starts. It's random. Like, I love the note app on my phone. It's gotten to the point where I am talking into it because we're hands-free states. I ain't trying to get in trouble. You know what I mean? But if I have a thought, I'll be like, turn on the notes app and just talk through it. Mm. And actually, Dumi Lewis told me to do that. So shout out to Dumi, too. He was like, you know, if you can't write it, just talk it out. And I'm like, that shit actually works. Wow. Like,
he's also the one that put me on the Outkast the most. We were freshmen at Morehouse on the fourth floor of Du Bois Hall, and he played that album. Because he would blast that album all day, every day, even before I got access to a radio, because I had no car. He did that. So it's funny you mentioned him because he ties into all this. But continue. I'm sorry. Yeah, you talk it out.
It's all good, man, because it's Dumi, man. Dumi is bomb like that. I mean, he's wonderful. I love him. But yeah, so he was like, just talk it out. So I mean, like, when I'm first starting a project, I hate starting a new project because Chronicling Stankonia is not my dissertation. I want to make sure I put that out there. So it was kind of me, with the exception of that one chapter that I seriously revised. I was starting from scratch. So it was mostly me talking to myself for a year. Mm. A year. I was like, oh, okay, I think I want to talk about this and using the sticky notes. And, you know, one of the things I miss most seriously about being in this pandemic is going to the library and just posting up in the stacks. Like, that is my safe space, particularly at Emory. Like, Emory's music library is bomb. Like, it has a nice view. I just go out there. It's free to go out there and park on Sundays. Yeah. Just going out there and just posting up for the whole day and just be like, you know, I'm going to read this. I'm going to think about that. But that's the part that I enjoy. The part that sucks is when you have to actually explain it to somebody else.
Right.
And that's kind of where I am now. I'm like, I have a new book project. I know what I want to say. I just don't know how to say it. So it's kind of like, how do I work through that? All you multiple book people, y'all make me sick. You and Mark make me sick. The other Mark. Man. Mark Anthony Hill. These 50-11 books y'all got.
Man, you on your way.
I don't know. I'm going to have to, because it's like, you know, I just feel like that's another part of my writing process is I feel like I have stories that I want to tell. There are stories and experiences that I've seen that have been significant to how I view the world, how the world views me as a Black Southern woman, that I'm like, yo, I need to tell these stories. And I just feel part of it is like that ancestral push. I'm the first college graduate, PhD graduate on my mom's side, you know, or PhD graduate on both sides, but I'm the first college graduate on my mom's side. And hearing stories from my grandmother about my great-grandfather being murdered because he was a Black business owner in Albany in the 1920s. It's like, there's so many different stories I want to tease out. In a lot of ways, I feel like I'm picking up where Zora Neale Hurston left off just for Georgia. Mm. And, you know, there are a lot of Zora Neale Hurstons out here, which, you know, from I don't consider myself a Zora, but I do consider Zandria Robinson a Zora. You know what I mean? What she does in This Ain't Chicago and what she does with
Chocolate
Memphis and how she talks about it. I'm just like, for real, right? So it's like being willing and being courageous enough to write. That's the basis of my project, because there are so many of my folks behind me who didn't have the space to write and think. So I just feel like it's my responsibility to pick that up.
Another thing that you've picked up is the mantle of hip-hop studies, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I came up, I'm not old, but I'm old enough in this academic world now to say that I've been around from almost all of hip-hop studies. You know, I was a graduate student in the 2000s writing a dissertation that took up hip-hop. And I remember being told, you ain't gonna get no job, you know, from folk. I remember going to the Tupac conference in 2003 with Mark Anthony Neal and Michael Eric Dyson. And I think Trisha Rose was there. Greg Demetriadis was there.
Oh, wow.
So many folk were there. Rest in peace, Greg. And I remember it was like all the hip hop scholars in the world were in this room at Harvard. And I was a grad student. I was just there. I was just taking notes.
Yeah.
But I remember how hard it was at that moment to even imagine hip hop studies as a growing and burgeoning field that the academy would respect. We respected the work and we knew the work was good, but it was still very early on. Do you feel now, that was almost 20 years ago, do you feel now as you look at the field, and as you look at people who are writing books on hip-hop that is taken more seriously, do you feel like the work is respected? Is it something that you have to explain? Like, I do hip-hop, but I'm really smart. Like, is, you know, as a subtext, like, is any of that happening?
Yeah, Yeah, I still deal with that because, like, I still get the question, well, why do you want to write about Southern rap? And I'm like, have we not met? Like, have you not? There is still this assumption that anybody who writes about hip hop can write about anywhere that hip hop exists. And that's not the truth.
It's
a lie and a half. I can't talk to you about Philly, New York. I can't in the way that you can because you experienced the shit. Like, I think that's one of the things that hip hop studies grapples with is that I, and clearly this is in the book, I cannot separate my personal experience from my research interests in hip hop. And kind of like you pointed out, and I was actually, it's kind of funny, I was talking to my students about this yesterday. I was like, hip hop is still hella young in the academy. The academy been around for how long? We're not even in the academy. We're not even 30 yet. Can you believe that? Like 94, with, you know what I mean? We still got a couple years to go, but it's like, that's still young. Now, when you put Southern rap into that conversation, I can name on my fingers who's doing Southern rap right now. And there's still not enough. There's still not room, right? I mean, like you have the music journalists who have done it, you know, shout out to like Charlie Braxton, for example.
Yeah.
But in terms of like the academy, there's me, there's Xandria, Mako Faneuil, Fadera Hadley, Langston Wilkins talking about slab culture. Nobody can talk about Houston like Langston, for real. But I mean, like you have these folks who are doing particular things, but like there's still all of this space. Like I can't talk to you about the significance of Cash Money's impact on New Orleans. I know what his impact on me was, but not what happened in New Orleans. So that's why I end the book like I end it. Like there is such a dearth of scholarship based on region that we're still playing catch up. So like by the time that folks don't ask questions about why are you studying hip hop in like 2030, 2040, probably still be like, oh, okay, well, why Southern rap?
Why the South, though? We get Northern hip hop. That's a staple of the academy. That's part of the canon.
Not good enough for you. Like, it's not good enough for you to use this to talk about the South. And I'm like, no.
Word. All right, well, before you go, I got a game I like to play with my guests. This game brings me great joy.
Okay.
It doesn't usually bring joy to my guests.
What you about to do?
It's called Buy It, Borrow It, or Burn It.
Oh, no.
I'm going to name three books.
Okay.
After I name the three books, you can pick one that you can buy, one that you can borrow, and one you got to burn.
Burn that bit. All right.
And you can tell us why. All right, so the three books are Black Noise. Rap Music and Black Culture in Contemporary America by Trisha Rose. The Games Black Girls Play, Learning the Ropes from Double Dutch to Hip Hop. And the third one, Prophets of the Hood, Politics and Poetics in Hip Hop by Imani Perry.
Oh, that's bullshit. This is bullshit.
And by the way, the Games Black Girls Play for those is by Kyra Gount. I just didn't say
that. Yes. You know what? You're going to have Imani and Kyra come after me after this episode.
Every episode is like to say, ask Bettina how hers went.
I'm going to have to. You know what? I'm going to. Okay. Let me think. Buying Imani's book. I wouldn't have my scholarship if Imani didn't introduce the possibility of an urban South and introduce this idea of outcast.
Okay. So we're going to buy Prophets of the Hood, Politics and Poetics and Hip-Hop.
Prophets of the Hood.
Okay. By Imani Perry. Go ahead.
Gonna borrow Trisha Rose.
Okay, you're gonna borrow Trisha Rose's Black Noise, Rap Music, and Black Culture Contemporary America. For those that don't know, that is a staple of hip-hop studies.
Bible.
It is the first major book published. It's actually, it's based on her dissertation, which was the first dissertation on hip-hop coming out of Brown University. And then it was a major book, the first major book on hip-hop studies, first major study of hip-hop culture. And it's still, as you said, a staple published in 1994. That means you're going to do what with the third book?
Gonna burn it.
Okay. That's what we finna do then. The Games Black Girls Play, Learning the Ropes from Double Dutch to Hip Hop, and of course, by Kyra Gow. And of course, we don't want to burn no books. We love all these books. We love all these authors. And of course, I'd love y'all to buy all of them. You can go to UncleBobbies.com or you can go to bookshop.org/shop/UncleBobbies and buy all the books we've mentioned today. But one had to go, and you picked The Games Black Girls Play. I'm calling her today.
Oh, man, I know I'm about to get this email. What?
Look, you had to pick.
I'm like, it's Mark's fault. It's always Mark's fault.
It's always Mark's fault. Look, I had Michael Denzel Smith on here interviewing me about my book, and he made me play. And he made me pick.
What did you play?
I don't even remember my three choices. I just remember being mad as hell and saying, I'm going to take it out on everybody else the next time. So I just made the game harder.
See, Mike, come on now. Okay.
He thought he helped, but he hurt.
My feelings, I am in them.
It's all good, but you did it as well as anybody could do, and I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of this book. How can people get a hold of you, though?
You know, I don't know. I've been acting a fool on the Twitters lately, but Twitter is at Red Clay Scholar all together, or www.redclayscholar.com. Holla at me.
Yes, please do. Holla at her and get this book. It's called Chronicling Stankonia, The Rise of the Hip Hop South. Regina Bradley is a star. She's a scholar, and she survived the game of buy it, borrow it, or burn it.
Well, we're going to see what the aftermath is after this airs. But okay.
Exactly. That's true. It's too early to say. All right, y'all. I'll see you next week.
Y'all be easy. Thank you.
Coffee and Books is a production of Embassy Row. Our executive producer is Sarnie Rogers. This episode was produced by Karis Nelson. The show was edited by Maureen Bigas. And you can follow me on Instagram at Mark Lamont Hill and the show on Instagram at Coffee and Books Show. Catch you next week.